Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, July 11th, 2003. Today's session is African Studying the Bible, Session 4 of Afro-Asiatic Roots of the Old Testament, presented by Peter Nash. The number is NAP 2003-04. Let's listen in.
My name is Peter Nash, and this is sort of a breather in the middle of a bunch of theoretical stuff to take on some other theoretical stuff. Most of this week I've been talking about African or Afro-Asiatic roots of the Old Testament. I'm going to take a session today to talk about what's going on in Africa as they read the Old Testament more or less on their own terms. I say more or less because most of the people have been educated in the Western world, in the North Atlantic. 14 of them have been educated in Africa, but Southern Africa, the universities in South Africa can be even more Western than the West. And I didn't check the dates just now, but up until 1990, it was quite possible to, quite difficult to do anything that I would call creative on the side of broadening the vision of the Africanality of the Old Testament in South Africa. Certainly there were pockets where things could happen, but for the most part, it was the universities a part of the conspiracy to maintain the white supremacist powers of apartheid. So I'm going to do a couple of things. I threatened, promised that you all would help me write a book review that I have due sometime at the end of this month for this book here, which is the first on the list, Old Testament Research. I put study as Old Testament Research for Africa. Interesting use of the preposition there. A critical analysis and annotated bibliography of African Old Testament dissertations from 1967 to 2000. It was published in 2010. And this is one of the sweet ironies of academic work. This is written and funded in Norway. Knut Holter is a professor of Old Testament at anybody here speak Norwegian? Mission School? About 10, 12 years ago, he decided that he would combine his interest in Old Testament with his interest in mission in Africa, which has been a strong component of the mission high school. High school there is not our high school. It's basically university level. And they are actually now offering a PhD in Bible and in theology. So they are parallel to the University of Oslo. The people from the University of Oslo don't accept that yet, but the government does. So it's a first-rate academic institution that has a long history of mission involvement in Africa. And Knut spent a lot of time on buses in Africa, going from school to school. He has some interesting stories about what kind of support and resistance he met from other missionaries or from practicing missionaries in some cases, and other academics who liked or didn't like the way he was trying to find out what Africans were doing with the Bible, with the Old Testament in particular. One here that's really important. There's a Canadian who describes himself as a missionary to the United States, Grant Lemarquand, who in this third book, The Bible in Africa, Transactions, Trajectories, and Trends by Gerald O. West and Musa Dube. Gerald West is an English-speaking white South African Musa Dube as a Botswanan woman feminist New Testament scholar, Gerald West Old Testament scholar. 2 years, 3 years ago, they published a book about this thick with Brill, which unfortunately means very expensive. 500 pages plus, a collection of articles from the 80s and the 90s by Africans, principally by Africans and by Knut Folter, people studying how the Old Testament is being studied and written about in Africa. This book here only deals with doctoral dissertations. And in the introduction to the book, Knut explains why he did that. There are other places where you can read devotional material if you can get your hands on it. One of the problems with Africa, with any place outside of the main axes of academic scholarship being Western Europe and the United States and Canada, pretty much the publishing industry determine what we're going to read. They think they can sell it, with the exception of a few publishing houses like Orbis, that specializes in what we call third world liberation theology literature. All the publishing houses are in trouble, and they have to find something that they're going to be able to sell. So something that's a little off-center or a little different from what's going on than what's selling right now, they're a little afraid to take a risk on. Gerald West is a pretty big name. Musa Dube is a pretty big name. There's some interesting things in that book because you can, it's probably, if you can get your library to buy it at an academic institution or your public library, perhaps. It has actual attempts at interpreting the Old and the portions of the Old and New Testament from an African perspective and with African points of view. Musa Dube's article, for example, is about how to pray the Lord's Prayer from a Botswana woman's perspective. What does it mean to actually enter into that world? It has a lot to do, I would say, with solidarity, understanding, putting yourself in the place of, and taking the risk with the person who's in another situation. Mm-hmm. I listed up here also Yahweh in Africa, essays on Africa in the Old Testament. This is a book of proceedings. It's proceedings, excuse me. Every year now, for the past 6 or 7 years, there's been a group of African Bible scholars who pick a theme, and they meet together for 4 days a week. And out of that, they publish the papers that they present to one another. And this is the first in this series. Knut's book was the third in this series, the Old Testament and the Bible in Africa. I don't know what the second one, but the 2001 one should have been published, and I'm just not sure what it was, because Knut didn't give me a copy. so just a quick idea to see some of what's happening. I left Grant and Mark on the Canadian missionary to the United States just hanging there, didn't I? He teaches at an Episcopal seminary in Pennsylvania. I've forgotten the name of the school. If you just do a Google search on Grant Le Marquand, MARQUAND, it'll pop up. And he did a 200-page bibliography, which is included in the Bible in Africa. So maybe it's more than five. I said 500 as well. On what he found being published in Africa by Africans about the Bible. That's interesting because in the preface to that article, that bibliographic article, he talks about having discussed this with colleagues, learned men and women in the field, that he intended to do research on what was happening with biblical studies in Africa. And the general response was, well, there's not enough to do. Somehow he came up with 200 pages of bibliography for him, there's not enough to do. Generally, repeating in a way, generally speaking, in the modern West, we don't think anything's happening. And that's one of the reasons I like this book so much. Since 1967, stopping at 2000, there were 87 doctoral dissertations written by Africans on topics of the Old Testament, and Knut's not convinced that he's got all of them. I know that one more has been produced in Brazil. Brazil's not on the list at all here, but in 2002, and then Golden Woman finished finished her doctoral dissertation at the Universidade Metodista de São Paulo, the Methodist University in São Paulo. So there are at least 88 Africans from the continent who have written doctoral dissertations. You may know two of these people because those of you who are Lutherans, I knew his name until I started to say it. One is Ambrose Moyle, who until a year and a half ago was the bishop, the Lutheran bishop of Zimbabwe, and now he is the regional coordinator for all the Lutheran churches in Southern Africa, living in South Africa now. He did his doctoral dissertation at Harvard in the New Testament, and was a visiting lecturer for a while at one of the sabbaticals at the LSTC, back when I was teaching in Evanston, Illinois. And was a lecturer, senior lecturer for a long time at the University of Zimbabwe in Harare. Emmanuel Granson, Edward's not in this book because it's New Testament. Emmanuel Granson from Ghana, also associated with LSTC as a graduate student, his doctoral dissertation there in Chicago, is one of our ELCA pastors. And I believe he's serving in the Washington, D.C. area. As an educational director for a division for outreach experiment in the megachurch phenomenon. So there's a lot of stuff happening. You know, from 67 to 2002, at least 88 doctoral dissertations were written, many of them published. And I've got some of the figures that Knut has laid out here for us to see. It's really sad when it's second place. Yeah. The Italians are beating us by three. But together with not the Italians, our friends, together with them, Knut points out that we are 43 of 87, nearly 50% of all of the dissertations that have been written either in Italy or in the United States.
That's where they were written.
That's where they were written. And the variety of institutions is interesting. I'll try to be a little more specific about that in just a minute. Ten of them were written in Nigeria. That's the most of any African country. Let's remind ourselves that Nigeria is the most populous of all the countries in Africa. Plug my former home. The second most populous African country in the world is Brazil. Nigerians, 34 Nigerians, or 40% of the dissertation, of these 87, I'm saying 88, El Buda, dissertations were written by Nigerians. There's some interesting things going on there, both about Anglophone and Francophone Africa. 60 of the dissertations were written in English, 27 were written in French. And there are, I think, a dozen countries that commit sites here that are Anglophone, and 10 that he cites that are Francophone. So it could be a little closer, but his conclusion is that English. We lose the Italians, but we win on the side of what is the language of scholarly discourse in Bible at the end of the 20th century. Pretty much, when I started this business, if you want to do Bible, you really had to read German. Now you don't have to read German. As you'll note, that not one of these was written in Germany, although I know of some Tanzanians who have done New Testament dissertations in Germany. Not one of these was written in Germany or in German. Even the person who wrote in, well, probably the person who wrote in Switzerland wrote in French, but may have written in English. So, they're just some, for me, kind of interesting, and very interesting for Knut, since he put them together. Details about the distribution of how things are being done. Any questions or observations so far?
Question on the timing. I'm a naive optimism, but does that mean, say, that in Nigeria that there are more established Old Testament departments, so we can expect those numbers to be trundling along quite nicely from here on? Or
yeah. In the last couple of decades, there have been more state universities that include theological studies as a discipline in Nigeria. So that probably we'll be seeing more Nigerians writing dissertations. I'm not sure if this is in the book, but in a side comment that Knut made to me, he said that the ones that are being done at the university, the major university that has most of these, is they're not really that good. The Nigerians who write outside of Nigeria are writing better dissertations. And he made a similar comment about Italy. He said that only two or three of these were written at the Pontifical Biblical Institute, which is the cream of the cream. And most of the rest of them were written at the Universitario Urbano. I can't speak Italian. But which is where they send third world or non-European, where they bring non-European scholars or catechists really to do masters, and if they're really insistent, if they're pretty good at really insistent, they can stand into a doctoral dissertation. So it's not as strong a doctorate as even if some of these others said, according to the man who actually read them all, or read parts of all of them.
Are there some common themes that can be sensed coming up out of these dissertations, interests that these scholars have?
I'll pay you in just 1 second for that question. That's he's organized this geographically and thematically. I wanted to get the geographical numbers stuff out of the way, and then I'll kind of slide through his last chapter about the themes. Yeah.
Did he look at all what the people are doing now? So Emmanuel couldn't go back to Ghana at the time. I don't know if he can go back now or not, but in either case, he's here. At the same time at LSTC, there was two South Africans, one white and one black, working on doctoral dissertations, mostly to be here and not there. And then when the government turned over, they went back. Didn't finish the dissertations. They went back to do the work they needed to do in their country.
I'll answer your question, your question raises another point. In the introduction to the book, he makes it clear that he's talking only about black Africans. So even in the inclusion of South Africans here, he's not including the white South Africans, only black South Africans. Because for the most part, he says white South Africans or white Africans have access to the North-North axis, Europe, United States axis, and they make more money, and they can in general, maybe not at the same rate, but certainly far better, far more easily than black Africans can participate in the mainstream of biblical scholarship. One of the comments that he makes is that, especially with the Roman Catholics, I didn't put that stuff up here, I'm going to refer it to the book to find it real quick in a minute. But with everybody, I already mentioned Ambrose Moyle, who's in the New Testament. He hasn't been in the classroom for about 10, 12 years now. Was lecturing at the university, was elected bishop, and many of these people are, fortunately or unfortunately, the most competent or the best trained or the most Westernly trained people in their communities, religious and civic communities. And so they get swept right up into administration of some kind. And so about half of these people are no longer in what we would call mainstream academic work. Even those who are, it's very difficult for them to publish because they get administrative tasks piled on their shoulders along with the teaching load and the research that we expect people to do. So to stay sharp on the edge is kind of tough for them. The same thing happens in the States, just that we have so many doctors, not necessarily African-American doctors, or Latino doctors and doctores, but we have more. Although, this is an interesting comparison. In 2000, Vincent Wimbush, who until May was the professor of New Testament, or a professor of New Testament at Union Theological Seminary in New York, he's going back to Claremont where he did his PhD now, an offer that he described as just too good to turn down. In 2000, he published a book, African Americans in the Bible. And in that book, Randall Bailey from ITC wrote an article about us, you know, black African American biblical scholars in the United States. And in Randall's counting in 2000, there were only about 110 of us in Old and New Testament with doctorates in Bible. So you might be expect there are more Africans than African Americans. Long shot. This is one of the things that's become very clear for me as I've had some great opportunities to travel in Latin America and in Africa. African Americans are just as imperialist as regular Americans, as you might want to say. And we think we define the African American, the Africanish experience. Well, there are more Africans with PhDs in Bible, but there are as many, or nearly as many Africans. No, that's only Old Testament, 87. So there are more Africans with PhDs in Bible than there are African Americans. And it's kind of a sobering reality for me and my imperialism. Anything else? The last chapter of this book is on is thematic, and I'm going to run through this, kind of flip through the pages as he's laid it out, and he's laid it out, and then come back and talk about some of the details. He's listed it as comparative studies, exegetical studies, and thematic studies, and then he does a summary. In the comparative studies, he lists things as using Africa to interpret the Old Testament. That's some of what I've been doing, what I've been trying to do, I hope, responsibly this week. He also talks about using the Old Testament to interpret Africa. That is, reading the Old Testament stories into the African experience rather than the way I've been doing it. Translating, the third there in comparative says translating the Old Testament in Africa. The third comparative perspective found in analyses with a translational focus was defined above as the approach where supposed cultural parallels between Africa and the Old Testament are used to bridge the gap between the source text, the Masoretic text, and the receptor text, the African translation. So in response, or a partial response to your question before we got started, Knut's only looking at the Masoretic text in this topic, which is just interesting because, as I mentioned, the whole Roman Catholic tradition is going to be pretty much a Septuagint, Vulgate tradition using, as most of us do in the West, this is something that most of us aren't aware of, most of the Western Church really works out of Greek, Latin to the receptor language tradition. And it's, in spite of the fact that we as Lutherans think of ourselves as children of Luther, we don't really lean on his translation of the Bible for the most part. The RSV, the New RSV, the NIV, when there's a, not always, but often when there's a question as to which way we're going to go, we go with the Septuagint and not with the Masoretic text. And you can see that when you pick up the translation by the Jewish Publication Society, which was published in the you know, finally devised in the, I think in the 80s, Tanakh, where there's just some little differences that come up because they go strictly with the Masoretic text, the Hebrew text, leaning on the commentaries of the Talmud, whereas we follow the Western Christian tradition, which comes through the Greek Latin tradition. Um, he goes through listing some of these people, the exegetical studies. He divides it into three traditional listings of the Old Testament, Pentateuch, prophets, and the writings. And there are people who have written in all of these areas. And an interesting phenomenon is the question of the Proverbs. I mentioned this at the end of the period of the session yesterday, that one of the things that popped up in the starting in the 70s and 80s is a comparative look, which kind of crosses the lines that he's got here, looking at the proverbs of various cultural groups in Africa and comparing them with proverbs in the Old Testament. Looking for literary parallels, looking for thematic parallels. And there are a couple of interesting things about this. One is when Klaus Westermann wrote one of his last books, The Roots, the translation in English is, the title in English is translated The Roots of Wisdom. The subtitle has escaped me, but it's something like Proverbs in the Hebrew and other cultural traditions. And he cites a couple of African dissertations that were just being finished when he was about to publish that book. Another thing that's interesting is that the German feminist theologians have really latched on to the Proverbs as a source of wisdom, in large part because of Proverbs 8 and 9, where wisdom is personified and listed as co-creator with, I'm not sure if it's Yahweh or Elohim there, but present at creation. And so there's been an interesting connection between feminist lines of research and some of the African lines of research, jumping in and digging into the Old Testament Proverbs and some African Proverbs. So some of the people who've done some of the most interesting work, as far as I can see, are French Africans, and the best of the dissertations that I know about was written by a French-speaking African. I can't remember his name. And the German feminist theologians in the Old Testament. Apocrypha thematic studies. It says 9 dissertations in the present material can be grouped as thematic analysis of these. 3 of these focus on central Old Testament institutions, covenant, Aaronic blessing, and the priesthood. The 6 others focus on Old Testament concepts, time and space, on human sacrifice, on myths, people of Cush. This is David Tuesday Adamu, who has been in the United States, did his dissertation in the United States, I think, at Baylor, and is probably the best-known proponent of the Old Testament in Africa, or Africa in the Old Testament, that one is likely to hear of. He's a Nigerian. The collective, on collective and individual responsibility, and another Nigerian on wisdom and old age. So those are some of the themes. Those are 9 themes that he cites as thematic as he presents this material. Traditional historical critical scholarship is also reflected throughout this material. And as far as the African context of the officers is concerned, it is also reflected, although in various ways. And then, of course, exegetical analysis explicitly to corresponding African phenomena. Coming back to the question of covenant, still the best example with regard to how African context is reflected in the hermeneutical preferences of exegetical dissertation is David Adamu's analysis of the Old Testament portrayal of the land of Bush. Then he goes on the lexicographical studies in classical translations, and then the summary of the chapter. the lexicographical studies, lexicographical studies. He lists Timber Mofika, who was also done in Atlanta, who studied at Harvard. The root Shafat, Mishpat, justice, comes from this root, which Timber wrote about and published a fair amount about maintaining a balance within the community. Who else is he? So the root trust, the verb anna, which means to answer, in this case with reference to the Lord, or God responding. The question, the verb yada, and its nominal cognate da'at, to know or acknowledge in Hosea. And the word pair, tzedek tzedakah, righteousness in Isaiah, are some of the things that these people have worked on. So it sort of sounds like there's a lot of stuff going on, and I come back to this challenge, well, why don't we know what? Why is it so odd to hear about it? Why isn't this stuff being cited regularly? Why are these people having so much trouble getting their stuff into the mainstream? Shtavamir. I think it's hilarious that the best place, if you want to know about African Old Testament study, the best place in the world to go to get at all of it is Stavanger, Norway, which nobody outside of Mission heard about before 1972 when they discovered oil off the North Sea. And this little mission town, this little town of mission houses, became the center of the Norwegian oil boom. Because up until about 1972, they didn't know, they denied. The Minister of the Interior actually said that if he found even a thimble full of oil in the North Sea, that he would drink it all. And now this little pious town is a booming Texas-type oil town. And that's what it's best known for now. But they still have the Mission High School, the Mission School, the School of Theology there. I was invited this week to talk about mission, having just finished a very nice 8 years in Brazil, but ended the last 18 months with some problems with DGM. I was hesitant to talk about mission. But here's one of the positive things that I can say, is that this mission school has funded and sought funding from the federal government in Norway, where they don't have our lovely separation of church and state, at least in certainly not in research. So the Norwegian government and this mission school started by mission societies 130 years ago has made it possible for us to get a book like this at least into our libraries and understand that there are things going on in the world that often are ignored, otherwise being ignored. So a lot of good stuff is still happening in Michigan.
This isn't to do with academic biblical studies particularly, but showing that an interest in African religion is, I think, entering the mainstream consciousness. Last October, in the Atlantic Monthly, there's an article by Philip Jenkins called The New Christianity, and it's more about Africa, I think, than other countries. But gives you some idea of the theological and popular religious currents of Africa. And it's really, he teaches at Penn State, but he's an Englishman or Welshman.
So October 2002, Atlantic Monthly. Yeah.
2002, yeah.
His point is that the weight of world Christianity is shifting to the Southern Hemisphere. Mm-hmm. And also perhaps eastward from Europe.
Yeah.
And the character of that Christianity is more evangelical, conservative, and the battles when the Anglican bishops get together at the Lambeth Conference are just kind of tipping the iceberg. So that's just what Clarence sees. But that's happening all over the world, and it's a real kind of challenge to.
And the Europeans don't know it yet, in a sense. I mean, they haven't realized
it. They don't realize that they're kind of on the margins.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is what he says anyway.
Yeah, that is so true. That reminds me that I promised to say something about Knut's bus rides through great stretches of Africa. Knut is Norwegian, Lutheran. For some of you that means nothing, but for some of us that means everything. and fine, whichever it means. But Knut ran into some interesting opposition at one of the Lutheran seminaries in East Africa when he began to try to explain, when he was invited to give a lecture, and he explained what was going on in Africa. And one of our Old Testament colleagues told him that he had just undone everything that this professor had worked to do in his, I don't know how many years of teaching Old Testament at that seminary, because he just didn't want African people to think that there were African connections to the Old Testament. That was a North American missionary. This also happens, as Jonathan has just indicated, with some Africans. Now, not every African wants to find African connections to the Old Testament. They're educated for one reason or another, for good and for bad, in sometimes some very traditional forms. And so to bring the idea that perhaps the drum that the missionaries chased out 50, 60, 70, 100 years ago, to bring them back into worship, not to claim that some of the traditions that African traditional religions celebrate are in fact related to Israelite traditions, is a very frightening thought for some of these people. I hope I'm not judging them harshly, but it's an interesting interplay as to who gets to decide what's African. I mentioned already that I think a lot of North American and African Americans are just as imperialist, sometimes more imperialist, to decide, try to tell even Africans what it means to be black, which I think is pretty funny. How to do black theology, how to do African theology is something that Africans need to work out. How to do academic study of the Old Testament is something we need to work out together. In some ways, they are in danger of being marginalized again. First, they were marginalized because they weren't sophisticated enough to do the theology of the 1920s, 30s, 40s, and 50s. And now, in some cases, they're about to be marginalized again because they are doing exactly that, the biblical theology of the 1930s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, when biblical theology has moved on to a different place. And I don't know that Germany, Cambridge, Massachusetts, Oxford, England has the right to decide for everybody in the world. As a matter of fact, I'm pretty sure that they don't. But we assume that often. What is biblical theology? How we're going to read the Bible together as a community of faith, as various communities of faith. So this is some of the stuff that's on the table, that's at risk. As we talk about how Africans are, in thousands of pages of production over the last 40 years, talking about, writing about, in academic fashion, the Old Testament and the New Testament. Comments?
I have a question. A couple of years ago, I don't know if someone has heard this or seen this PBS episode about it. Anthropologists who traced black Jews
in Judah Parfi.
Is that okay? And then, so they had that. So that raises for me the question whether or not there's possibilities for the Hebrew Christian collaboration, the Hebrew Bible that we hear about in other contexts. Is that something that could emerge, or is emerging, or is that already addressed by?
Either I'm really slow, or your questions are fuller than I can get at, and so I have to ask you to explain a little more.
I'm sorry.
What you want to?
Yeah, well, if we've got Jewish communities in Africa, I don't know if there would be, they've got then a living tradition of the Hebrew Bible, I presume, then maybe, since we're benefiting by Christians talking to Jews about Hebrew Bible scholarship, so, at least I hear that in my commentaries and all of that, And it's like maybe this whole exploration of African connections could work through living Jewish communities, no? Or is that too naive?
From what I understand, there are two communities that I know of. One was the Falashas, many of whom were airlifted out in Operation Moses in 1988 from Ethiopia. And they took several years for the chief rabbis in Jerusalem to confirm that the cultic practices, the worship practices that they were carrying on, were in line, were very similar to practices that go back, I can't remember, but at least 1,000 years, things that were being done in traditional Jewish homes and synagogues 1,000 years ago. Mm-hmm. That's one group. Tudor Parfit, who is a Welsh anthropologist, I think, has made his career searching down odd diaspora Jewish communities. So there are Jews in some of the most unexpected places, and he goes and checks up on these people. When he was talking in South Africa about the Falashas, he encountered the Lemba people. Right? So they came to his lecture and said, "We are one of the lost tribes of Israel." The Lemba people have a social organization that reflects Israel. And there's always a question of, did they get this from the Bible and do a back formation, or is this their direct line? And so he spent some time with them, told their story, wrote it up, and then a few years later, when DNA mapping became a possibility, he went back and took swabs of the land of a tribe or a clan organization to these people, with 12 tribes and 12 clans. One of them, which is known as the eldest brother, the Bubba, I hate to say that after the Clinton administration, or the Bush administration, I don't know, that might have moved to the south. As the priestly clan. So they're known as the eldest brother and the priestly clan. So when they took the DNA samples from them inside of their cheeks and compared them with the Kohanim, the hereditary male priesthood in modern Judaism, but very traditional, they have the same, the genetic marker that has long been identified for the Kohanim is present in almost the same incidents among the Bubba clan of the Lemba people. It's a very interesting story. I think it was part of this PBS series that you're talking about. I can't remember the name of the book that you wrote, and then we wrote after we went back and did the DNA sample. But it seems that the questions of who's a Jew and how we determine that, I don't know if they did any DNA samples with the Falashas in Ethiopia. But in both cases, a living tradition, but a living cultic tradition, not the textual tradition that one would need to do what I think you're asking about. As far as I know, neither of these groups have strong textual tradition.
Oh, they don't have a Hebrew Bible with them in their
I'm sure that there's some part of the Hebrew Bible in the among the Colossians. It sounds like among the Lemba there is no written tradition. I don't think we're going to get much help there.
Okay.
You're talking about the professors. As far as the students at the seminaries go, we certainly heard again and again, both in East Africa and West Africa, that the Old Testament is very congenial to African people. They say, this is our life, this is the way we live. They feel right at home. They're not that conscious of the millennia that have passed since it was written. It's very living present. And I said, so I tell them, there's a lot of this stuff you're going to understand better than I ever will. So,
And that was
Lemke. Tell us about it.
I said at Lemke yesterday, but they who says just that, that they have some things to teach us because that their lifestyle is closer to the lifestyle of the Hebrew Bible. Well, it's important it will come back.
Even the customs, you know, the way of doing marriage and even some of the laws of the Old Testament, there's a lot of similarities. Hospitality.
For who hasn't heard yet, Jonathan and Mary spent decades in Africa, in Nigeria and Tanzania. So they're here to keep me honest. Any other observations or questions?
I had a question about the seven people. Are they all men?
I couldn't tell by the names. He doesn't mention that. And that's why I was sort of excited about the 81st, the 88th that I know of. Elvira, and I forgot her last name, but she's Angolan. Very definitely mother of two. And there are some others that I think there are three or four women in this bunch, but for the most part, so those who I could identify the names or people that I knew or knew of, they were all men.
Is there any identification as to who is a seminarian or ordained person?
None of these people are any more seminarians. Almost all of them are religious Roman Catholics or ordained clergy in one of the, pretty much in this bunch, in the mainline Protestant denominations. Some of that administrative stuff, for example, is go on to be bishop, go on to be rector of a theological training institute. One of them, is cited as one of the most promising in French-speaking West Africa, is immediately after finishing his dissertation, he became responsible for the training of novitiate, what is the young seminarians who are preparing for the priesthood. So, as far as I remember, all of them.
I think the best known Nigerian theologian outside of Nigeria is Mercy Odioye, who is a woman.
Mm-hmm. But she's primarily New Testament, right?
I don't know. She's not Old Testament, I don't think.
I'm pretty sure she's not either.
She may be New Testament, but she may also be ethics or something. Outside of biblical studies, yeah.
No, she's not here, so she's not Old Testament. She's got half dozen books.
Yeah.
Even translated into Portuguese. I'm about out of gas here. I don't have much else to say. I could spin my wheels a little bit more about some of the stuff that's in these other books. But the chief point has already been made. That is that there's a whole world burgeoning. And as Jonathan has highlighted, how it's about to burgeon and which direction it will go and how we carry on the conversation with them is up in the air. This is just about academic study today, the devotional study of the text, the base communities, here's an interesting piece of confusion. Base communities, which are primarily known as Latin American based, in the late 70s, early 80s, some South Africans invited some Brazilians to go to part of the CD, the sent to this, to this, the Center for Biblical Studies, which is based community studies, to go to South Africa and teach how they were doing based community studies. That spread out through South Africa, and now these same South Africans, Gerald West is involved in this, have been invited to Norway to teach this methodology in Norway and these mission societies. The Southern Hemisphere, in a lot of different ways, is beginning to teach the Northern Hemisphere how theology might be done in a more personal, still with high academic standards, but at different points from where they're expected in what we call the modern West. Another thing, supporting the comment, the article from the Atlantic Monthly, if you go to the Lutheran World Federation website, www.lutheranworld.org, I think it is, and you have to kind of look around in there, but they have statistics that they put out about May of every year as to where the church is growing. And they're always about a year behind. But the church is not growing in Europe. The Lutheran churches are not growing in Europe. The Lutheran churches that are members of the Lutheran World Federation. They are not growing in the United States and Canada. They are growing in Africa and in Asia. And they're growing fast. In Latin America, the last statistics indicated a growth of about 2,000 people, which I take to mean that one of those Latin American churches that wasn't a member of the Lutheran World Federation became a member and brought us 2,000 people. Because I know that the church that I served and our neighbor church in Brazil, they're in a consistent downward spiral in terms of membership.
I read that the average ELCA in the United States is 58 years old.
So I'm still doing it.
That's because they live so long.
Yeah.
Like her mother.
My mother is one of those. Excuse
me. So where do you think they're going with this? There's like, that's like almost a 40-year span. I think a 30-some year span, and it's about 30 every decade. About 30 people trying to be, you know. Do you think that's going to go up?
There's some interesting things here. I think it's going to continue to go up in Africa, especially in Nigeria. This is what Knut said. Knut points out that the 23 the most has remained pretty stable throughout these four decades, or three and a half decades, that the numbers are something like 8, 7, 6, or, you know, they add up to 23, but it's, you know, pretty, I think 8 was the first, and then it went down, and then up, something like that. In the United States, a lot of people are coming to the United States. They continue to come to the United States. And so the numbers have gone up. It started with 3 in 1967 and 1968. And it just keeps growing. So I think we'll continue to see a lot of partnership, as mission folk like to say, bringing folks over here to be educated. So there will be a continuing opportunity for us to have an influence, and I hope to be influenced by these people who come to study with us and teach us by their presence. I think that the Nigerians and the South Africans who have really strong public education, by African standards, really strong public education systems, will continue to produce scholars. And as is the case in the States, in Europe, some of them will be good and some of them will be second grade and third grade. And so we'll continue to see who publishes and who makes it into the unfortunately very capitalist system of publication and academic research. What frightens me is how many of these people come to the United States, come to Canada, go to Europe, and don't go back. And I think one of the things that we need to do is to to look at how we use our NGOs and non-governmental organizations, how we use our mission offices to make it possible for people to live with some kind of dignity in their own country after they've experienced all that stuff of Europe and the United States and Canada. The photo display in the Village Center is just it's striking. And if you know that one in 165 children die before the age of 5 in the United States, and 1 in 10 die in the United States, and you got a kid, it's not very hard to think. Where do I want to be? To increase the chances of my child or my children, our children, will have a chance of happy, healthy life. That on the surface is enough justification to get out of Latin America, get out of some parts of Asia, to get out of Africa. And then it's the whole question of becoming accustomed to the creature comforts. So how can mission make it possible for our partners to live a reasonably comfortable life without pilfering the funds, without fleeing the country, the great brain drain that we saw in the Middle East, for example, 20, 30 years ago, and from Asia, to really be in solidarity with these people so that we have partners who aren't just mimicking us and telling us what we want to hear. Anything else? If not, I'll thank you for your attention and I'll see you at next.